Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 30th of January. Chip Duncan is with us this hour. Chip has just returned from Darfur and Kenya. In Kenya, he's writing the screenplay and co-producing a feature film on Mohamed Amin, considered by many to be Africa's greatest photojournalist. And he also has just returned from Darfur and actually landed in Kenya the day that all of the violence began. He didn't expect to be encountering what he had encountered. Chip is a filmmaker, author, lecturer, president of the Duncan Group, which is a documentary and feature film production company based here in Milwaukee. Recent productions he has many include The Cost of Freedom, Civil Liberties, Security, and the USA Patriot Act, Beyond the Gridiron, The Life and Times of Woody Hayes, In a Just World, Abortion, Contraception, and World Religion, The Magic Never Ends, The Life and Work of C.S. Lewis, Rafting Alaska's Wildest Rivers, Worth Fighting For, People Protecting the Great Lakes, Mystic Lands, a 13-part documentary series on spiritual places of the world. He also, we were just talking about Machu Picchu a couple days ago on this show, and I had forgotten that Chip guides trips on Peru's Inca Trail to Machu Picchu, so he can maybe at some point talk a little about that. And he spends considerable time in the Alaskan wilderness, so he really is a person of the world. Kenya and Darfur are topics of conversation this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Chip.
As they say in Kenya, jumbo.
What do they say? Jumbo?
Jumbo.
Jumbo. I like that.
I know. It's a great hello.
It's really, it really sounds like
it's
hello.
Better, it's better than hello.
It's
jumbo.
It's a big hello, jumbo. Well, I knew you were going to Darfur, but little did you know what you were going to encounter when you landed in Kenya. That was another story. It was an unexpected story.
It really was. I had originally planned to land on the 27th, and my friends that I'm working with in Kenya said, you might want to wait a couple days just because the elections are happening, and it's kind of crazy. Well, I did wait a couple days, and turned out that I landed literally the day the violence to erupt there. And it's been a phenomenal month, really, for Kenya. Not a particularly good one, but it's a great country, and I do think it'll succeed in overcoming these problems.
You said you're drawn to it. You're drawn to Kenya and to Peru. What about Kenya?
One of the things I love about Kenya is actually what's creating some of the problems right now, which is the diversity. It's extremely diverse, and I guess a testament to that is that I have some great friends there who included me in their poker games while I was there on Saturday nights. And the second poker game, I looked around the table and counted up the number of languages that were being spoken, and there were 9 languages going on. So, of course, every time I won a poker hand, someone swore at me in Swahili or Hebrew or something. So it was kind of fascinating. But it's the diversity. I mean, certainly the wildlife and the safaris and the natural resources are extraordinary. But it's, to me, it's really the hub of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Africa, a lot of South Africans would take issue with that, but I think Kenya is the hub.
I was reading the article in the Christian Science Monitor a little while ago, part of it on the air, and it talked about Kenya being a model of what other African-American countries could achieve. Under the placid surface, Kenya, this article says, boils with deep ethnic resentment that some observers say has been ignored for too long. Would you agree with that?
Well, I agree that the resentment is there. I don't necessarily think it has been ignored. In fact, one of the things that I've noticed in a lot of the coverage, two interesting things in the coverage. Early on, I thought the coverage was, because I was there, I could see it, and then I'd go back and watch BBC or CNN. And the initial coverage I thought was very overblown and was not accurate in terms of what was going on. But the other thing that's been intriguing to me is that very few people have paid attention to the history. And there are some really stark similarities between what's going on now, what happened in the early 90s when the democracy movement really took hold, and especially what happened in the late 60s. Raila Odinga, who is the leader of the Orange Democratic Movement, the opposition, his father was embroiled in many of the same conflicts going back to the Kenyatta administration in the late 60s. And so you can see parallels when you really study it, between what was happening then and what's happening now. Ultimately, it's about disenfranchisement. And so, you know, it's funny because the two major tribes that are in conflict right now are the Kikuyu, which is the group that is currently running the presidency and the administration, and the Luo. Odinga is Luo, and the current president, Kibaki, is Kikuyu. And the joke in Kenya right now is that America will have a Luo president before Kenya does.
Barack Obama is Luo.
Barack Obama's ancestry traces back to Luo, yes. So, but the conflict, you can go back to the late 60s, and there was a key event in Kenyan history was the assassination of a Luo presidential candidate in 69 named Tom Mboya. And Mboya was Luo. And many people thought that he would succeed Kenyatta, the first president of Kenya. Well, he was assassinated, and he did not succeed him. But the riots that erupted after that, and especially in the rural areas, were largely confrontations between Luo and Kikuyu. So it's not new. I don't think ignored would be the way I would phrase it. Simmering, yes.
Mm-hmm. So what touched it all off on December 27? Tell me more about the election. Yesterday there was an incredible violence in Kenya. You've checked in today and it's not as bad. But for this country that has been this model of democracy, and as you say, you're drawn to it, there's diversity, there's wonder, it's a really good place. What happened?
Well, the election happened in late December on the 27th, and the results were contested almost immediately. But the initial results, the Kenyan Election Commission verified the results and said that the current president, Mwai Kibaki, won the election. But he won it by a very slim margin, and I'm told it was under 200,000 votes. There was a third candidate who's now the vice president, and he managed to get about 800,000 votes, which was greater than the margin of error between the two primary contenders. But when Kibaki said he claimed victory, the Election Commission backed him. Then Raila Odinga, who was the opposition, who apparently, 200 votes is a pretty slim margin, although we're talking about probably 9 million total voters, fairly slim margin, and he refused to accept the results.
Mm.
So when I first got into Nairobi, the chants from people around town were no Raila, no peace. Mm. In other words, if you don't put Odinga in, there's not going to be any peace. When I said before disenfranchisement, Odinga's party, the Orange Democratic Movement, was representative of a lot of the more disenfranchised people in Kenya, and in particular, he had enormous, and still does, has enormous popularity in the slums in Nairobi and also in the Rift Valley to the northwest of Nairobi. So most of the violence that's happening in Kenya has really been fairly isolated to the Rift Valley communities that are where the two tribes are squaring off, and to in Nairobi it's been primarily in the slums. What happened 2 days ago that was a little bit startling and different was that one of the ministers in the Kenyan government was actually assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
So his name, Mugabe Ware. Mm-hmm. I don't know much about him, but he was assassinated 2 days ago, and that happened just outside of the Kibera slum.
Mm-hmm.
So
you talk when you've written in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about your time there that like many of Kenya's less privileged, they have never had a leader quite like populist Odinga. What's special about him?
Well, he does fit the populist mode. He's a very good orator. He's very confident, very commanding. I wish I could compare him to someone running for president here right now, but we really don't have anybody like him in this election. And I think what's been fascinating watching him is that he's refusing to back down. I mean, at the moment, Kofi Annan is there, and Kofi is the first person who's managed to bring the two, the opposition leader and the current president, together to actually have talks. But nothing in Odinga's language is backing down. I mean, he's not accepting the results of the election, end of story. And he's rallying people who really have, in some ways, they have the time on their hands. They're largely unemployed in Kibera. and they've been living in poverty and watch. It's been an interesting last few years in Kenya because the country has progressed enormously in the last 10 years. The income disparity is not as bad as it was. There are more jobs. There's in general, the economy is on the upswing, and a lot more tourism. They're thriving on,
sure.
or they were thriving on tourism. Now you can't find a tourist in Kenya anywhere.
Yeah,
In fact, when I flew out, there's nobody. I flew back late last week, and there's nobody flying in except for aid workers and UN and
right.
That sort of thing.
I think you also wrote, Chip, that millions are still left out.
Well, they are left out, and left out of the political process because they have no clout. And the interesting thing is, I'm not I wasn't raised there. I don't have a stake in it other than my personal interest. But there are people who are Kikuyu who have been sort of born into a kind of privilege that the rest of the country hasn't really been a part of. And in fact, I was listening to your show yesterday with the gentleman from the Atlantic Monthly, and a lot of what he was talking about with Iraq, you could make the same case here that the boundaries are really artificial boundaries. The Kikuyu were they're considered the more privileged class of Kenya, and to a certain extent they were given that kind of designation by the British when the British pulled out. So you see, colonialism and the roots of colonialism and the tragedy of colonialism really playing out now a generation later or two generations later. And you see it in Iraq. You see it in Sudan, in the Darfur crisis. You certainly see it in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about that is you can make a general statement and say, well, Kikuyus are the privileged elite of Kenya. But the truth is there's a lot of Kikuyus that are dirt poor that are living side by side with, their Luo neighbors or their Kamba neighbors or their Kalenjin neighbors, and so it really is a hodgepodge. Poverty is poverty,
yeah.
And so it doesn't really matter what tribe you're from.
So what's the break in this? Kofi Annan is there. Odinga refuses to accept the election results. How does it budge? Does somebody else come in and try to go beyond just talks here, or do we need another election, or how does it break?
Well, the interesting thing is that there, Kibaki, the president who assumed power, he already had power, so he was incumbent. It was easy to say, I won, and I'm reelected. Well, it's hard to get him out of the state house. But the election is disputed now by international organizations as well. The EU said it was suspect. The little bit of mutterings we've heard from the United States government are that, gee, it doesn't look like it was a fair election.
Mm.
That's about all we've heard out of the U.S. government. So it's safe to say the election itself probably wasn't fair. Now, the more they've analyzed it, they've also found that there were irregularities among the Luo voters as well. Is there a 200,000 vote swing either way? Hard to say.
Right.
But the interesting thing is Kibaki has agreed to another election in theory. He said, well, why don't we just hold it again? But he said that after the vice president was installed, and the theory is that those 800,000 votes from the vice president, who was a third party, would probably wind up going to Kibaki. So it's easy for him to now agree to a new election because he'd win it. Where does it go and what happens? I really don't know. I've read and followed everything I can, and people were making early comparisons to, oh my gosh, is this Rwanda? Are we looking at Kosovo?
Mm-hmm.
Because when the violence becomes ethnic, when it's one tribe killing another tribe, it does have a certain resonance with what happened in Rwanda. There doesn't appear, although I've seen articles talking about premeditation of some of the violence, it doesn't really appear to have the same seeds or the same motivations that Rwanda had. So I'm not saying it won't get worse, it might, but I don't see the long term being anywhere near as tragic as what we saw in Rwanda.
You were indicating earlier by statement that the United States could be doing a little more here.
We've really seen the U.S. do almost nothing. There was an early statement from the U.S. ambassador in Kenya calling for peace. Condoleezza Rice has said, you know, we really got to get the two sides talking and calm down. But there's been, you know, to me, it's the kind of conflict where you say, you know, a destabilized Kenya in East Africa, in that region of the world, is not a good thing for anybody. Right. And I'm uncertain as to why we haven't taken a much bigger step. My sense is if Colin Powell was still the Secretary of State, he'd be there. Hmm. The closest that anybody has come is Kofi Annan is there now, but he postponed his first trip, and then he finally decided to come back in. He got there on Wednesday of last week, and he's still there. They are still talking. Mm-hmm. So
you were tear gassed. What happened?
Well, the film I'm working on in Kenya is on Mohamed Amin, who was a journalist in Kenya, photojournalist, and he's a fascinating character in African history. And so I've been there working on that story, and his son, Salim Amin, is still a journalist in Kenya. And so as background, I went out and covered the news while I was there a couple of days. And it was a fascinating thing. You know, I was a news photographer for years, so I'm used to the scene. But I was out with Salim and his group, and there were about maybe 10 or 12 journalists, international journalists, standing on a corner in downtown Kenya, kind of waiting to see what the opposition movement was going to do that day. A lot of rioting had been taking place. And the police decided – there was probably 75 to 100 police on the corner, and literally out of the blue, they decided to rush us.
Oh, my. Oh,
so,
my.
On horseback, about 10 police on horseback came with clubs and started swinging their clubs at us, and we were literally just standing there. And I've all the years of journalism, I've never been attacked by police. So first they came after us, then they went back to their little safe spot, and then more journalists, because of that, the whole journalistic community showed up. So suddenly there were 100 journalists on the street corner, and they started tear gassing the journalists. So we got gassed four times, and of course it played poorly for the Kenyan government, because the CNN anchor woman was actually hit by a tear gas canister in the middle of a stand-up. So, I mean, and there were no protesters around. We kept going. It was
my goodness.
In all my years of covering, I've never seen anything like it. We were just standing on the corner, and they decided, well, there's no protesters around. We'll go after the journalists.
Oh, my.
Generally speaking, that hasn't been the case, and it hasn't happened again. But it was almost silly. Because journalists are not going to run away. We just all stood there like, yeah, you know, taking pictures.
Did you get any work done on this documentary on Mohamed Amin?
It was hard. Because
I'll bet it was.
I did. I actually did. I was there for 3 weeks, so I did. But the after going out for a couple of days, I finally said to Salim Amin, and I just said, Salim, I've got to work. This is fun, getting tear gas and everything, but I really got to go back to work.
Let's welcome some phone calls. We're talking about Kenya, and also we'll talk about Darfur a little bit later this hour. Chip Duncan, who's a documentary filmmaker from Milwaukee, has just returned from both places and is with us in studio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. You can also move the conversation into Darfur, because Chip was in Darfur. We'll talk about that. He also blogged every day when he was there, looking mainly at the humanitarian perspective, and we'll tell you how you can get that blog as well. All right, let's go to some phone calls. Jacques from Whitefish Bay, hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm curious as to does Raila Odinga, does his movement transcend social issues, or is his movement purely a represent Lule ethnic issues? And don't Lules live west of the country, and the Kikuyu live in the eastern part of the country?
In terms of transcending social issues, yes. His campaign was not really based on the idea that I'm a Luau and let's have, you know, get his tribe to vote for him. It was much more broad based than that. Generally speaking, he represented the poor, and so in terms of the locations of the tribes, I'm actually not an expert on that. The from what I understand, most of the Luos who are most of the violence and most of the Luos who are going after the Kikuyu, it is in western Kenya and the Rift Valley area. So it's the city of Kisumu. Eldoret was where the church fire was back in early January that killed about 50 people. Mm. That was the original flashpoint that where people started saying, oh, my gosh, I hope this isn't Rwanda all over again, because so many people died in churches in Rwanda. But Jacques is right. It is most of the violence is in western Kenya.
Yeah. When you talk about nobody coming into the country, we have this image in our mind, and a lot of people go to Kenya, as you well know, to see this incredible wildlife, one of the last frontiers, see the animals may never be with us much longer. I would imagine that a lot of people in government on both sides might be a little bit upset that they're disrupting the economy, aren't they?
Not only is it disrupting the economy, I think it's disrupting the economy for a long time.
Really?
Even the hotel I was staying in, while I was in Nairobi, the number of people who were laid off just during the time I was there was I would say they laid off probably 30% of their staff.
Ooh.
While I was there.
Wow.
And in Mombasa, which is a big tourism area, over 20,000 people lost their jobs while I was there.
Oh, so, my gosh.
So the question becomes, you know, forget your tribal designations or histories or any of the ethnic reasons that you might have conflict here. If the money goes away, you know, then you're looking at millions more people who are disenfranchised. And so what happens then? That economy has really grown based on tourism. Now, it is pocketed. The violence is in pockets. And so unlike Darfur, where there's a general sense of insecurity and violence throughout the entire region, you can navigate Kenya right now by staying out of certain areas and still going on your safari if you want to.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Andrew next. Hi, Andrew from Montford. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
This is picking up on the last thing that you were just talking about. Well, I'm very curious to know what types of pressure, particularly the Kikuyu business community, is putting on Kibaki. And if Kibaki is really just become strongman, with a military backing, but that also raises the question. I heard that there's reticence to use the military because the military is so ethnically mixed and not particularly Kikuyu. Who's propping up Kibaki, and where are the Kikuyu second-tier leaders here?
Well, judging by what I know from when I was there and the people I was talking to, one of the reasons that Kibaki had not called in the military was because he doesn't know where they stand. Right, Andrew's right, that there is extraordinary diversity, tribal diversity within the military, but also within the police force. Now, the police force, for the most part, seemed to be unified in the approaches they were taking, whether they were tear gassing journalists or the way that they were containing the slums and the violence in the slums. They seemed to be fairly unified despite their ethnic differences. But from what I gathered from the people I was talking to in Kenya, Kibaki doesn't know where the military stands. And so they've not called – there have been some GEM, which is a paramilitary group, has been called in a couple times. But for the most part, it's been a police action. As in terms of the business community, I think the pressure is really starting now. I think we're going to see more and more pressure on Kibaki to do something. The question is really what? I think Kofi Annan's probably trying to figure that out right now. If Odinga will not accept the outcome of the election, and he's got a fairly strong voice among the impoverished in the entire country, then what? I mean, and I don't think anybody there wants a full-scale civil war of any kind. So at some point in Nairobi, what we saw was people literally just wanted to go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter what their ethnicity was. They just wanted to go back to work and try and maintain the economic status that they have. But I know in my experience anyway, I would say that European travelers in particular would probably come back to Nairobi fairly – or to Kenya fairly quickly. and they probably get far more news on Africa and Kenya than we do, if certainly the BBC does. So they might return fairly quickly in a matter of months, but American tourists wouldn't.
Is there – describe to me – thanks very much for the call, Andrew. Is there a great difference in terms of charisma, in terms of attracting supporters, in terms of calming people between Kibaki and Odinga? Are they vastly different kinds of guys?
I would say they are. I mean, in our political history, Odinga is more like a Teddy Roosevelt. Very big, outspoken. He's a large person. He's a booming orator. Where Kibaki is interestingly quiet, even now, even in the past month. He's 76 years old. They're trying to change the constitution right now to put a 65-year age limit on the presidency, which is one of the reasons Odinga is so upset, because he's
63.
Yeah, 63. Is he?
So, what did you say? 62, right?
But yeah. I know he can't run again if they pass this law. I would say generally, Kibaki's more of a grandfatherly presence, and he wasn't. Prior to this election, I wouldn't say that while there's been an undercurrent, the ethnic tension has been there. He's certainly never been perceived like Daniel Moy or Jomo Kenyatta, the two previous presidents. He's not a dictator. Now, he has done a number of things since the election that are that don't smell good by our standards, and a great example of that is he immediately stopped live news broadcasts as soon as the violence began. So a lot of people in Kenya were upset by that and said, well, you know, we can't even get the news live. Talk radio was taken off of the air. So there was a level of censorship that happened almost immediately. Now, the government said one of their motivations for doing it, what they were telling the people was that they weren't censoring. They were delaying the news. And so what they were trying to avoid was the use of radio, in particular the way it was used in Rwanda. And if you're at all a student of the Rwandan genocide, you know that radio played a huge part, live radio in particular, played a huge part in that genocide. So, you know, international observers may or may not have felt that he was doing the right thing, but it is still – live news is still banned in Kenya. So it's interesting because the BBC is live, CNN is live. The international news services are live, but the Kenyan stations are all on a delay. And you know, I guess you'd have to call that censorship by our standards, certainly. And so Kibaki has done things like that, but he's an older, kind of more grandfatherly character, and for the most part has been very quiet throughout this whole ordeal.
Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Chip Duncan is our guest, documentary filmmaker from here in Milwaukee, who has just returned from Darfur and Kenya, landed in Kenya, you know, anticipating doing a lot of work on a feature film he's working on a great African photojournalist, but the day he landed was the day that ethnic fighting due to the disputed outcome of the elections took place, and so his journey took a different course. He also spent time in Darfur and has blogged on that, and we're going to move into Darfur, but feel free to join our conversation on either one of these major stories. 800-486-8655, 227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 227-2050. And how did you get into Darfur? It's really hard to go there, isn't it?
It is, and I did not go as a journalist. I went as a humanitarian worker with the Group Relief International. And so it's almost impossible to get into Darfur as a journalist right now. In fact, I was documenting the work of Relief International for them for fundraising purposes. And so I was there with cameras, which were promptly confiscated when I arrived. And I had to put a bond up to get my cameras back. And I was severely limited in terms of what I could photograph while I was there. I was allowed to photograph essentially in the camps for displaced Sudanese Darfurians, and that was about it. I wasn't allowed to take photos almost anywhere else. So, we got in on a visa with Relief International, so it was a humanitarian visa.
Mm-hmm. And were you knocked out by what you saw?
I was. I consider it a privilege that I've been able to travel and document the many places around the world that I've been in, and I've for example, been in Haiti or in Ethiopia or in Kenya in the Kibera slum, where I've seen some very desperate, very difficult situations. But I've really never seen anything like Darfur. I didn't come back with a sense that there is hope. And that's the first time in my life where I can say, gee, I just don't see it. And I'm sure it's there. I mean, there's always hope because the kids are wonderful and, you know, you can always find smiles with children. And but the camps for displaced people, the refugee camps, and where do these people go and how does the government resolve this crisis? I really don't know. And maybe it's because despite the homework I've done and the first-person experience I've had, maybe I'm just still ignorant or naive about the situation there. But I just came back thinking, oh, my God, the only thing I can really say is that, you know, I'm grateful for groups like Relief International and all of the other wonderful NGOs that are there and providing food and shelter and hospitalization and medical resources and all of it. Because without them, I don't know that there's another place on Earth right now quite like it, and that's saying a lot because Palestine's no hotspot right now either. So it's, you know, there's a lot of difficult places, but Darfur is the worst I've seen.
Yeah, I've always wondered this, Chip. And we had one journalist with us some time ago who was in Darfur. It's hard to understand when you brought up Rwanda and when you talk about ethnic tensions in Kenya. It's kind of naive of me to say this, but I don't understand how people can be so horrible to other people, how people can just lose their sense of humanity completely and torture people and kill people and take everything from them. I have a hard time understanding how we can be so horrible.
I'm not sure I can help with that because I have the same problem. And you know, the work that we do, we're constantly, you and I are both exposed to it all the time, these conflicts. And yet in Darfur, it's the genocide there has really, really been unfathomable.
Yeah.
And it's for the listeners who don't know much about it, it's a country that has had the longest civil war in the 20th century between North and South. The North is predominantly Muslim Arab, and the South is predominantly animist Christian and Black African. And so that crisis has been going on for, you know, a generation. And then Darfur, which is in the north, kind of the mid-western part of Sudan, the crisis there has been happening for a long time, but it really has become, you know, front burner, front page news since 2003, 2004. Mm-hmm. When I was in Kenya, I talked to a journalist who'd been in Darfur and South Sudan 30 years ago and said the Janjaweed, the men on horseback, or some call them enemy on horseback, the word translates also simply to enemy, that faction, which has been related to the Sudanese government, has been there for a generation, that's not a new... It might be new to Americans or new to Europeans, but it's not certainly not a new phenomenon. But the rivalry there, to a certain extent, you could say that it's ethnic, and the reason it's been called a genocide is because there is ethnic cleansing going on, and at the same time, there are huge resources that have come into play. There, oil being the big one. And so what I find interesting is, for example, when the Bush administration decided to call it a genocide, that was a huge political statement for the administration. Now, we haven't really done anything about it, but it makes me wonder, why are we calling it a genocide versus a war? What, mm-hmm. you know, what came into play there to make us use that term? My personal opinion is that it's an appropriate term. But certainly there are bigger global politics going on there. The Chinese are the ones who are facilitating the building of the infrastructure around the whole oil industry there and seem to be the ones capturing the natural resources. So, you know, to what extent do those global politics come into play? You know, certainly the reason I was affiliated with Relief International and the reason I like what they're doing there is because the politics mean nothing, you know. I mean, we can't control, you know, on a daily basis what's going on between the Sudanese government, the Chinese, and the United States. But what we can do is bring in, you know, facilities for clean water, clothing, medical supplies, that sort of thing. And the need in Darfur is extraordinary. We were primarily in North Darfur in the city of El Fasher and the city of Kab Kabia, and we spent most of our time in a camp for an IDP camp just south of nine kilometers south of El Fasher called Zamzam. And Zamzam has over 40,000 internally displaced people, so huge number of people, and approximately 600 more arriving every week. So these are people who've been driven out of their villages, probably within a couple hundred miles of El Fasher, showing up with little to no resources. Oftentimes it's a mother and children and the father's been killed. And so they have nowhere to go and they wind up in a place like Zamzam camp. And who's there? The international aid community is there. That's it.
And we'll speak with somebody from the CEO, actually, of Relief International, Farshad Rastegar, will be joining us in a moment. And we'll take more of your phone calls as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Your business can support Wisconsin Public Radio with a challenge grant during our next pledge drive. Challenge grants provide a great way to support Wisconsin Public Radio while connecting with listeners. To learn how your business can support WPR, call 1-800-747-7444.
1-800-747-7444. Keep that number handy and call whenever you have questions about Wisconsin Public Radio programming. Our audience services staff is ready to assist you. 1-800-747-7444.
Coming up the second hour of our program today, Florida had its Republican primary yesterday, and Rudolph Giuliani is dropping out of the race today. John McCain won yesterday, and we'll be talking about all of that with David Winston. David joins us from time to time. He is a Republican strategist, and he is the founder of the Winston Group, has worked at the Heritage Foundation and also had a four-year tenure working with former House Republican Conference Chair J.C. Watts. So he will be with us. He's a fine guest after 10 o'clock today. We want to have we'll stay on hold. If you're on hold, we'll be with you momentarily. Farshad Rastegar is also joining us now. Chip worked with him, and as you heard him say, he was documenting the work of relief agencies in Darfur. Farshad is the CEO of Relief International, and thank you so much, Farshad, for being with us.
Hi, Catherine. Hi, Chip.
Hey, Farshad.
You are you as pessimistic as Chip seems to be about Darfur being able to become a better place at some point, Farshad? Is it so dismal that there's not very much hope?
You know, I think I was the first time I went to Darfur, and but, you know, I've had the, you know, the privilege maybe of seeing some change over the course of the past few years. And I think change comes very gradually. But, you know, in some of the camps that I visited the first time, I saw for the first time in my life, for example, people basically cooking the grass that we walk on here.
Oh, my gosh.
And feeding that to their children. That was, you know, maybe, you know, I've seen some pretty horrible things in my life, but so, you know, when you see those things, you it's hard to compare that with anything else. But, you know, after 2 or 3 years of you know, continuous work on the ground, you know, you change the situation in the camp. We have now, you know, nutrition feeding centers for children, you know, some of which Chip visited. We have, you know, clinics for women. So I think you do see some change over time, but that, you know, obviously takes a lot of effort and input. Let me also add that I think I was listening to your conversations earlier, and much like the discussion on Kenya, which I learned a lot from, much of the debate on Darfur and the past few years with Rwanda, with Kosovo, other sort of similar crises where large numbers of innocent populations have been in peril. A lot of discussion has been on what can the U.S. government do, or what can the various governments do. We've kind of taken the envelope and pushed it to the extent that, let me phrase it, much like the environmental debate. About 20 years ago, the issue was more about educating and bringing the issue to the sort of consciousness. Today, it's not about whether there is an environmental problem or not. It's about what can each one of us do about the issue. What kind of lamps do we change at our homes? It's much the same about Darfur and other sort of similar crises, where we as individual citizens of the globe can do something. Chip, as he decided to, he called me one day and said, "Look, I want to go to Darfur. Is it possible?" I said, "Yes." So Chip, by going there, documenting what is being done on the ground, is playing a role.
Sure.
Yeah, so similarly, Relief International is not a governmental organization. We call it an NGO, non-governmental organization, meaning we're a group of citizens, much like your listeners, that got together and said, well, we want to do something about the problems of the world. So we do have, it's us. Basically, you, me, Chip, others who got together and said, well, let's do a microcredit program for women in these camps so they don't have to go out and collect firewood and get raped. Mm-hmm. Let's put together a fuel efficient stove program for these women. Let's create a health clinics. So the point is, there's things we can do on the ground, which we call practical protection.
Mm-hmm.
So by being present, by having these activities on the ground, we're actually preventing the killings and the deaths and all that. So that's the gist of what the Chip's trip is about and what Relief International is doing and what we urge people to get involved with is not just the advocacy side of the issue, but in terms of practical action. And we have a lot of high schools that call us, high school students, and that say, yeah, we want to do something in Darfur.
Mm-hmm.
And we have college students, others. And so I think we kind of urge that kind of action, if you would.
Yeah. On the other hand, it seems to me as though the situation like this could continue with wonderful aid organizations like yours, and yet there has to be at some point some big push on the part of the Sudanese government, the U.S. government, and the Chinese government to change this situation, or it will go on and such horrors will exist for a long period of time. Don't governments have to become seriously involved here?
Well, yes. I guess our argument doesn't take a responsibility off of the shoulders of governments.
Yeah.
However, what we're saying is that everybody has a role to play. You asked earlier about how is it that some people commit horrible crimes against others, and from historical studies of the Nazis to elsewhere, we know that it's always a minority
mm-hmm.
who
mm-hmm.
perpetrates this violence against sort of innocent people. However, a silent majority either sort of kind of like looks at it and just turns around, or some kind of get involved in kind of supporting the system.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, we're seeing, we're not only suggesting, but we've seen in the last, like, say, 10 years, this movement away from just educating people to see it. Because, like, we keep saying never again. It keeps happening. So in
right.
the last 10 years, we've seen this movement from the more... Non-governmental sort of side of the issue, civic participation, where individuals volunteer to go to Darfur And again, by virtue of the presence of international, individuals, and they don't have to be government.
Mm-hmm.
Violence stops if you are as an international, whether you're a humanitarian person in a village in Darfur, the Janjaweed are not going to attack that village.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. How were you, considering the fact that your camera equipment was confiscated, how were you able, and maybe you'll do this subsequently through more writing, Chip, to document the work of the international relief agencies?
Well, I did get my cameras back. I didn't mean to imply that they were confiscated for the whole
trip. Oh, okay, okay. Because I saw some pictures here.
To Relief International, I was able to get them back. And we spent several days in Darfur documenting. And in fact, I wanted to mention the stove program that Farshad mentioned. I think is one of the best things that they're doing. And I agree with what Farshad has said, and I don't mean to convey that there is no hope, because there always is hope. But the stove program is a great example. One of the greatest threats to women has been when they're out collecting firewood for cooking. And the stove program that RI is doing has created these fantastic fuel-efficient stoves that dramatically reduces the amount of fuel required for cooking. So, of course, what does that translate into? Less time out in the field looking for wood. And there's some amazing opportunities there for people, even in a displaced camp like Zamzam, to be educated, to get health care, all because of groups like RI.
Yeah. You must, though, on some level, want to just gather everybody up and get them out of there.
Well, I guess that's what I was talking about with hope, is I don't know where they
go. Right,
And it does, I will say mobilizing the world community to say we want a better situation for these people. I think just a leader in the free world, like the President of the United States, can make an extraordinary difference. In lieu of that, what Farshad is talking about, I think, is true, which is everybody listening to your radio program right now can donate to Relief International or a similar organization that they're passionate about, and help bring more consciousness to this whole situation. It doesn't have to be the way it is.
Yeah. Let's go back to some phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. George from Rubicon, thanks for waiting. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Jambo, BB Kathleen, and Jambo Buona Chip, Asante Sanak, Kwaziako.
You've been there.
I love that.
I was a Peace Corps volunteer for 3.5 years in Kenya.
So
I learned my Swahili pretty good. I also did get into southern Sudan. And, in fact, I lived and worked as an extension agent on the edge of the Rift Valley, and was in Eldoret quite a bit. That was the biggest major city next to us. So this, all these events really strike close to my heart. A couple observations, Chip. The Luo are mainly from around Lake Victoria, which is a lowland area. The Kikuyu occupy the central highlands. They were the first who were westernized by the British, which kind of gave them a leg up on everybody else. When the British left, they were the ones the most educated, the most entrenched in the bureaucracy, and they're very ambitious people, used that to their advantage. I'd like to make one observation about the ethnic conflict between the Luo and the Kikuyu, which you did not mention and is perhaps not the most polite subject to talk about, but the Kikuyu are circumcised, the men are circumcised, the Luo are not. And one of the things that I detected as I worked day in and day out with people of many different tribal groups is this becomes a very important thing in their relationship, in interaction with each other.
How so?
Perhaps you observed that. Well, I'll give you the best example. One of my African bosses was a gentleman who was from the Kamba tribe that also circumcised. He had a master's degree from Cal Poly, and I was comfortable enough that I could ask him. And he said whenever he was dealing with somebody who was from a non-circumcised tribe, he couldn't help but think of his mother telling him, have nothing to do with those dirty men.
Oh, my.
So it is somewhat ingrained. I don't know if it's as important now as it was then. I think now the conflict is based more on economic disparity than it is on those cultural differences, but it's there just below the surface if you're aware of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You must be particularly disturbed by what you're seeing in Kenya since December 27th.
I suspect that there are maybe not people that I know, but friends of and descendants of people that I worked with when I was there that are very seriously affected by this.
I'm sure.
Not some of those killed or injured.
Yeah, I'm sure. Thank you very much for your call. Jackie is next from Drummond. Hi, Jackie.
Yeah, I tuned in late, so I don't know if he discussed this, but I was really sad. I just read a little article in the paper that one of the young men from Kenya who had won Grandma's Marathon was killed in this strife, and I thought that really brings it close to home and also shows the futility of people who are really trying to better themselves, because when these runners come here and make money in this country, you know, they can go back and support, you know, so many people. And
Who was it who was killed?
One of the person who won Grandma's Marathon.
Grandma's Marathon?
In Duluth. You know, the big marathon. I think his name was Nidich or something. I didn't quite get it. When I read that, it just broke my heart, because it kind of brings it close to home. And and that all the articles have said that a lot of the runners in Kenya, because this is, you know, that's their athletic endeavor, you know, are really affected by this this strife that's going on. And I was just wondering if your guest had no one seen anything, articles or anything about this.
Chip?
I have not.
No, I haven't either. Well, Farshad?
I was going to say, I know two marathon champions have been killed so far.
Two marathon champions have been killed in Kenya. Oh, my. Well, let's keep hope alive, and you got blogs that you've done. We got, I'm sure you have a website, Farshad, if people want to learn more, if they...
Craig, our website is ri.org or reliefinternational.org, both would work.
ri.org.
And I will say, Kathleen, you've been kind enough to have Ben Kingsley and me on previously to talk about Pakistan. We worked with Relief International in Pakistan. And one of the reasons I've affiliated with this organization is, in addition to Farshad and his expertise, is the entire group is doing some of the best humanitarian work in the world today. And the money really goes into the field. It's an extraordinary organization.
Yeah. Well, at least somebody's in the field doing good work. You want more. It's interesting how, particularly in the Darfur, it's a street thing that's happening. It's people who are marching in Washington and even celebrities who are talking about this issue and people on street corners talking about it. It's interesting to see how we're learning about it, isn't it?
Yeah, I actually, having now been there, and Farshad's going there in about 2 weeks, I believe, but having now been there, I'm really impressed with the number of celebrities who've taken on the issue and who've personally gone there, whether we're, you know, Don Cheadle, George Clooney, Mia Farrow, the whole gang. I'm glad they're out there doing what they're doing.
Yeah. If people want to read more about your experiences, they go where, Chip?
The easiest thing is just our website. It's duncanentertainment.com. It's just all one word, Duncan.
Duncanentertainment.com.
Ri.org.
And ri.org. Thank you. Thanks, Chip, so much. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
We'll have some fun somewhere now, huh? Yeah. Chip Duncan, Milwaukee. Well, he's from Milwaukee. He's a filmmaker who has worked all over the world. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll be back and talk more politics on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.